listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And today, it is the spookiest of the months.
It's Board Game Bros.
I think it's only fitting that we talk about a spooky game.
Yes, and this is actually a special spooky game.
Yes.
Not only is it especially spooky, but this is actually sort of a new direction for us, new occurrence for us, because this is our first review copy we've gotten for a game.
Yes.
We were sent this copy of this game by the publisher, and so we're here to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We've made it big. We've gone, Hollywood?
Maybe.
But not Hollywood. I don't think the publisher is based in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Where are they based?
We've definitely gone up another sort of rung, maybe.
Yes. So very exciting to have been given the opportunity to review this game and have the review copy sent to us. If you'd like to send us a review copy of your game to review and post on, review on our podcast and upload to our feed and spread to the world at large. You can hit us up on our website, bgbcast.com. There's a contact page there that you can fill out.
Yes.
So, with all of that being said, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Fright, designed by Jeff Peters, Stephen Crow, Tim Huntsman, and Tim Roberry, and published by Solid Roots in 2021, this year.
All right.
I believe it is currently out. Based on their website, it looks like it is available for order.
Yeah, it looks like I can buy it now.
So it is, in fact, published and released
mm-hmm.
in 2021. Yes.
So like you said, we received a review copy of this game, so we played it, and here is our review. But before we kick things off, I'm going to open up with a quick short description about what the game is about. Then we're going to talk about strategy, and then at the end we'll talk about the design and we will give our review of the game. So, for a short description of what Fright is all about, by the way, the tagline for this game is "Bring a friend and a shovel." Ooh. All right. Short description. In Fright, players take a trip to a graveyard and attempt to scare each other to literal death. The last player left alive wins, but there's a catch. When a player is eliminated, they remain as a ghost and may still affect the outcome of the game. Each turn, all living players roll a die, then play cards to determine who gets to do the scaring for that turn. If you get scared by an opponent, you remove one token from your tombstone. When your fifth and final token is removed, you are eliminated and become a ghost. So that's the gist of it. It's sort of a simple game. There's a deck of cards, and all of the cards will either manipulate the dice or manipulate who gets scared or how much health a player has. And then the dice are used to determine who does the scaring. Basically, everybody rolls dice, and there are rules to determine, based on those rolls, who scares.
Yeah.
And there is no restrictions on who can scare who, unless a card would somehow prevent it or change it.
Yeah. So, for reference, the way the, like, dice works...
Yes.
So everybody rolls a d6... If every number is different, then the player who rolled the highest number is the only one who scares during the scare phase.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a pair rolled, then everybody who was in that pair get to scare, the scare pair. So if two players roll a four, everybody else rolled different numbers that aren't four, then the two players with fours could scare.
Even if those other players rolled higher.
Yes.
The pairs take precedence. It's sort of like poker rules.
Right. The one thing that isn't like poker is that if there are two pairs of dice, then the lower numbered pair is the one that gets to scare.
Yes.
So if there are two twos and two fours, then the players that rolled twos get to scare.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, three of a kind, all three players get to scare. Four of a kind, all those four players get to scare. And if you're playing a five-player game and everybody rolls the same number, everyone scares.
That's correct. And it is a maximum of five players that can play this game.
Yes.
So when you get to scare, all that really means is that you choose another player and you And having chose them, that means that they have been scared and they lose one of their tokens. So each player has this tombstone that has these five sort of like C-shaped rungs that stack up on top of it, or not on top of it, but around it, I guess. There are these tokens, and that's what you use to track your health. So every time you're scared, you remove one of these rungs from around your tombstone until you've removed the fifth one, or until you win.
Yeah. So with the way the game ends is there's either one player standing, so only one player has health, or nobody has health, which can only happen if the remaining living players die on the same turn.
Right. So, for example, if there's only two players living, they roll their dice and they get a pair, and nobody plays any cards to adjust that die roll, so either of them can scare. Now, technically, you can choose to scare yourself. So in this scenario, both players would have to choose the other player, or both players would have to choose themselves. But in this scenario, both players would lose their last health token, and all players would be a ghost at the end of the turn.
Yes.
In which case, everybody wins.
Right. So the way that works is that when you lose health, you draw a card from the deck of cards. You start with one card in hand. And the only way to draw more cards is to lose health. When you are a ghost, you no longer roll the dice, but you do still get to play cards. And those cards can modify health, or they can modify die rolls. So you can mess with the remaining players to try to orchestrate their downfall.
Right. So, for example, if they didn't play a roll, or if they didn't roll a pair, and one player is about to eliminate the other and then win the game, you can play a card to change one of the players' dice so that they do match. And then in that case, it's a pair. Both players get to scare. Both players eliminate each other. Everybody wins.
Mm-hmm.
That is if they choose once the pair has been made and they both get to choose who they scare to scare each other. They're, you know, anything. It's really up to them who they scare, unless you play the card that allows you to redirect a scare.
Yeah. There are cards that let you redirect scares. There are cards that let you just scare somebody anyways as well.
Yep, there's a card that gives you one health if you have any health remaining. There's also a card that can resurrect a dead player back to life with two health, but you can only play that if you're a living player. Ghosts cannot resurrect themselves or other ghosts. So the opportunity that you get to play the cards is a little vague, but basically there's this token that the game uses to help people track what phase of the game it is and which cards can be played. There's like a die roll side of the coin of the token. And then the other side is like is it the scare side or the
scare side? I believe
it's the scare side. So the token is flipped to the die side at the beginning of a turn. Everybody rolls their die. Then everybody just takes a moment to like pause and think and play a card. And one player can then just pause it to the group. Like, should we move on to the next phase? And if everyone agrees, then you flip the token over and you determine who gets to scare at that moment. Everyone gets scared. And then people can play cards after the scaring has happened or when the scaring is in progress in some cases. So you sort of get like two opportunities to play cards on any given turn. And it's up to your play group to determine how long those opportunities take. Usually they pass pretty quickly.
Yeah. Likewise, there isn't really an order for who gets to play cards when, as long as you're in the correct, like, phase. You know, it's not like there's a turn order or anything. So that's another thing where if your playgroup needs an order, you can add it. Or otherwise, it's just kind of play the card if you think you want to play it. Very, very vague.
Yes. Still. All right. I think that's about it for how to play the game.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. So if you couldn't tell, it's pretty simple. You know, there's just the cards, there's the dice, and then there's your health trackers. You roll the dice, play the cards if you want to, and keep going until one player remains. Oh, there is one thing I wanted to mention, and I think this is part of the rulebook too, that when it comes to actually scaring a player, how you do that is up to you and your play group. So if you're like us, and it's, you know, a weeknight, and you're sort of tired or groggy from the week, and you don't really want to put so much effort into actually scaring your other players, you just look at someone and say boo Mm-hmm. You know, you could at least add a little suspense to it if you want to make it a little bit of a spooky situation.
Yeah.
But if you really want to go all out, then the game encourages you to go for it.
Yeah. It says to, like, give it your best scare or something like that, you know, really put some, you know, action into it. But even if you aren't tired from the weekend or the week or whatever, you could still just, you know, do it however you're comfortable.
Yep. Finger guns. You can wink at each other.
A little spooky face.
Yeah. I think maybe it could be fun to tell, like, the last sentence of a scary story and insert the player in there.
Mm-hmm. Quoth Jeffrey, nevermore.
Yeah. And on the car door handle was a bloody hook being held by that player.
So that's
part of how to play.
Yes.
So strategy.
Yes.
It's a simple game. There's not much strategy, but I thought of about 3 points I could maybe add to this game. One of them is similar to like Munchkin. You want to hold your cards more often than playing them, because you'd rather use them when they save you from losing the game or when they win you the game, rather than just using them in the middle of the game when it's not going to make much of a difference on the outcome.
Yeah. This is especially because you do technically win if everybody dies at the same time. And so holding your cards for once you're dead means that you can still end up winning by using them.
Now, if you're like me and you're a little impatient and you want to play your cards anyways, especially if you see like a fun situation to play your cards, like maybe a situation that you could change a two pair into a three of a kind or what have you, then I suggest, you know, play those cards whenever you see fit. But when your health is starting to get low, then you want to definitely start to save your cards, because once you're eliminated, the only thing you can do is play cards. So you're probably going to want to have at least a couple cards going into the ghost phase.
Yeah.
The ghost mode, if you will. So save your cards. If you can't save your cards, at least save them when you're about to be a ghost. Those are points one and two.
Yeah.
And then point three is because the rules for this game are pretty flexible, there's a whole lot of room for doing anything else, you know, metagaming, going outside of the game to secure a victory. You know, if you really want to win at this game, then do anything that you can to win. You know, make deals, table talk, scheme, backstab, you know, whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
You can say anything you want to any of the other players.
Yeah.
Open and system. Maybe like make it theatrical, maybe get people sort of like into the spirit of it. If I had to give any sort of advice on how to convince people to join your cause and secretly help you win this game.
Yeah, the theme definitely plays for the like take that style of gameplay, and the role playing involved in the whole scaring people might make it easier to role play, you know, being a conniving gravedigger sort of person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, get into the role play, speak to the other players' characters that they're pretending to be, and maybe you could convince them to do something that is beneficial to you more so than it is to them or someone else at the table.
Yeah. I have a point, which is that I don't think hitting yourself is great unless you just want to be a ghost, which I guess is fine. But as far as hitting yourself otherwise, the reason you would do it is just to get a card. But the card will either give you one health, which means that it netted zero damage, or it would deal damage to somebody else on that turn or a future turn, which means you have net zero damage because you've taken one to deal one when you could have just dealt one to somebody else. And also it reduces your health so that you don't last as long. You would have drawn that card eventually just by somebody else getting lucky. If you're at one health, it's probably fine to scare yourself just so that you can go into ghost mode and focus on that from that point on.
I would say that a situation where it might be beneficial for you to scare yourself is if you're at max health or you have a decent amount of health and you have a card in your hand that will heal you for a point. So like that card is not going to have that big of an impact in your hand. It's going to heal you eventually, but you might as well just transform that into another card so you can scare yourself, draw a card from losing the health, and then play the card that heals you back to full health, or that heals you for that one health. So, like, right, your health doesn't change, but the card in your hand changed from one that isn't super useful to one that could be much more useful.
Right. My point was more that eventually someone's going to scare you to make you lose that health anyways, and mm-hmm. then you can use the card that heals you to actually go positive on health.
Sure, but think about this. What if you could use that card instead to, like, scheme with another player? Maybe you could make a deal. You know, sure, the heal yourself card isn't going to be a very good bargaining chip, but maybe a different card would be.
Sure.
I don't know. I think maybe if we played 100 games of this, we might come up with a couple more situations where scaring yourself is the right play. Maybe if, like, a sort of meta game develops as yeah. we've played this game. But from the handful of games that we have played, yeah, I think I agree with you that scaring yourself is generally not the play.
It is funny.
It is very funny. And in this game, you know, you can have your fun in a number of ways. The mechanics of the game don't really give you that expression outlet. So expressing it yourself in your own special ways and having fun with this game is part of playing it. And yeah. So, yeah, it's definitely funny. It'll get a laugh, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think that's about it for the strats.
I think that's about it for the strats, too. Let's see. Okay, we're about 20 minutes into the episode. That's not bad. Mm-hmm. Let's take a quick skip over to the plugs corner, or whatever mm-hmm. we're calling it. Do we actually have a name for where we do our plugs?
We don't.
Okay, well, we're going to go do some plugs, and then we'll be right back to talk about the design of this game. Right, it's the plugs segment. Welcome to the plug house.
The folks. Plug space?
The plug space? The plug boat.
Plug boat? Nice.
Welcome to the plug boat. All right. Here at the plug boat, we like to say a couple things every episode, such as you can follow us on Twitter at bgbroscast.com. Nope, that's our website. At bgbroscast on Twitter. You know, follow us for notifications for when our episodes go live and hear our little sneak previews sometimes that we do about our episodes. And hit us up with suggestions for games there, if you'd like. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we have all of our episodes posted and cataloged. You can use our search function to find episodes on games that you're curious to hear our thoughts on. And if you don't hear or if you don't find those episodes, that's because we haven't talked about that game yet. So again, hit us up with suggestions on our social media or via the contact page. And like we said at the top of the episode, if you have a review copy of a game that you'd like for us to review, you can contact us there and we will tell you how to get in touch with us. You can also find a link to our TeePublic store on our website. That's teepublic.com/user/bgbcast. And that's where we sell merch with our cool logo on it. That does it for BG Bros plugs. So let's hear it for Matt plugs.
I do another podcast called Net Surfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web, where me and a friend of mine cover interesting media from the last 20 or so years. We talk about different movies, music, video games, TV shows. We've talked about internet things, internet subcultures. This month, for the spooky month of October, we are talking about sort of video game adjacent spooky things. If you are familiar with Ben Drowned, then that is our first episode of the spooky month coming soon. You can also follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/twack, twitch.tv/twak. I stream on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time. I stream fighting games, competitive games of different types, roguelikes, platformers, speedruns, kind of just a mixture of things. Recently, I've been playing a lot of the new Monkey Ball remake, and I also, every Friday, play Hitman, and viewers can interact with me and make it harder for me to complete the objectives. So if you like watching people play video games, then check that out.
All right, and you can follow me on Twitter at JeffCraigDesigns for just... Usually I just like the things that make me laugh, and maybe they'll make you laugh too. All right, that does it for our plugs segment. So let's get back to the episode so we can talk about the design of Fright.
Okay, design time.
Design time. Yeah. You've mentioned a number of times that this game is pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
Simple strategy-wise, simple, pretty rules light. I want to start by saying some nice things about this game.
Yeah.
Because I do have some criticisms. But as far as nice things go, I can appreciate that this is a party game that has player elimination, but players are not actually fully eliminated when they are. You know, they're not removed from the game. They can still have a pretty big impact on how the game ends. And they have incentive to, because after a player dies or is has all of their tokens removed from their tombstone, you know, they can still play cards and they want to, so that they can achieve the tie condition where all players are eliminated at the same time. So I can appreciate that about this game. It's a party game where people get eliminated, but they're not actually eliminated, and they are incentivized to continue to participate. And another thing I'll say is that the rules that tell you who gets to scare based on the dice rolls, combined with the cards that manipulate the dice in the different ways, can lead to some pretty creative plays. And I will say that the last game we played, the player that won, my fiance, won with a pretty surprising card that I didn't really know existed. Now that I do know it exists, I might be able to see that coming next time we play. But yeah, so there's some surprising moments and some creativity that can be expressed via the dice manipulation.
Yeah. So with the way the player elimination works, it's kind of interesting because, like, because the only thing you can do when you're a ghost is to play cards, it sort of incentivizes you to hold on to your cards because of that. Because, you know, if you want to keep playing the game, you got to have cards after you die. Or, like, telling players that death in the game isn't the end if you do this thing makes them more interested in doing the thing because, you know, people don't want to lose. And so it in turn makes players have to consider, like, how they play their cards, which I think gets players into the mindset of, like, do I really want to play this card now, or do I want to be risky? Which kind of fits this, like, almost press your luck aspect of, like, you could mitigate your luck using the card you just drew previously, but you still have a lot of health, so you could just wait it out and see if a better chance arises. And I think that sort of risk is pretty fitting for the general theme and atmosphere of the game.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that the way you draw cards leads to, it's like a catch-up mechanic, but since you don't necessarily want to play the cards the moment you draw them, the effect of the catch-up mechanic is kind of delayed, so it doesn't feel as much of, like, an immediate rubber band snap.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like a slow escalation that reaches a very rapid and violent peak towards the end of the game.
Yeah.
It's, like, even sharper than a, like, an inverted parabola, you know, going up.
Yeah, it really reaches sort of a climax when the game wants it to.
Which is sort of like a scary movie, I suppose.
I think
they kind of really slowly build more and more suspense without actually paying it all off until a very crucial moment.
Yeah. I think that the like the way the cards are sort of set up to add numbers, since they all work in pretty small increments, it tends to make the games very close. Maybe that's also because as, like, a playgroup, we don't want to target somebody too much, so yeah, we have a tendency to spread the damage. But it felt like in all of our games that the health was fairly close by the end of the game.
Mm-hmm. So on the like the idea of spreading your damage, there is this sort of like experiment, like social experiment aspect to the game, where, like, who do you actually choose to eliminate health from when it's your turn to choose? Like, oftentimes it's just either the person that has the most health, or it could be the person who you dislike the most, or the person who's been like talking too much, or the person who has the least health because you're feeling vindictive, or maybe it's just random. You know, you have a die there. I guess you could roll it to choose who you eliminate health from. But that question of like who you choose is completely up to you, which does lead to some like sort of interesting like conundrums, like personal internal conflicts. Like, do I choose them? If I do choose them, will that make them more likely to choose me? Or, you know, it's certainly, because there's no rule in the game that tells you who you need to choose or who you can and can't choose. And also, since the game is mostly up to luck, so that like there's no real incentive to target a skilled or experienced player, because a skilled or experienced player won't really have much of an advantage in this game. It definitely leads to some interesting decisions. And when I say interesting, it's not interesting in the traditional like sense of a decision that you would make in a board game. You're not like using your resources in like creative ways or difficult ways. It's just like a very low but high stake question of who will I very blatantly target.
Yeah, I think that something kind of interesting with this game's like dice mechanics is that the way the dice comparison works is that it's high roll if it's a single die, but then it's low roll if it's a pair of dice, or if there's two pairs. And it kind of made me want to, like, if I had to adjust my die so that it pairs with somebody else, it made me want to pair up with the person who had the lower die, even if, like, there was no other pairs on the table. So, like, if there was, like, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I would want to adjust mine so it matches the 2. Just in case somebody else wanted to make a pair, they can't just, you know, usurp me. And it took a while for me to really appreciate why. Because, like, at first I was like, why isn't it high roll for two pairs if it's high roll for one? But I think it is to, like, make it so that if somebody gets the high roll by, like, being lucky, then playing cards will make it less likely that their luck remains. If it was high roll for pairs, then maybe you would want to match up with the six that's already been rolled, because that's safer. But then the person who played the six would have just still been lucky.
Right.
So it kind of has this like underdog approach.
So I will point out real quick that there are like a series of cards in this game. I forget the term when it's like what is it called in Magic when there's like a card of every color? A cycle. Yeah, there's a cycle of cards in this game that just adjust any player's die to a specific face. So there's two of each. So there's two cards that will adjust any player's die to a 1, 2 to a 2, 2 to a 3, etc. So the fact that it's high roll for individuals, low roll for pairs, determining what trumps, I guess that makes it so that the cards that can set a die face to a low roll have both uses, where either A, it makes a pair, in which case the lower is even better, or B, you're targeting another player to lower their die so that yours ends up higher. So there's sort of an interesting like dynamic there. Whereas the card that changes a die to like a 6, in one scenario, it changes your die to a 6, and now you're the highest single die on the table and there's no pairs. Or it changes someone else to a 6, which could make a pair of 6s when you are already, you know, in a pair of 2s or something.
Yeah.
Like, or maybe there's a 3 of a kind, like 3 2s, and somebody else rolled a 6. You could change one of those 2s to a 6 and break the triple into 2 pairs.
Right.
And be a part of the winning pair. Or, right. You know, or just leave a winning pair.
Yeah, it leads to a number of dynamic decisions that I didn't appreciate at first, but after I played, I really came to understand.
Do you want to talk about why we probably didn't appreciate them at the time, or...
I mean, I think at the time it was just that it took a while to really get through the rules. I mean, I think when it comes to game rules, having rules that overlap in terms of how they treat other components tends to be the, like, the preferred method of dealing with things. Which is to say, like, if you are valuing high rolls with one mechanic, usually you either value high rolls with a similar mechanic, or you value low rolls with, like, a different mechanic that highlights the opposites. But I think in this case it was more like a checklist that ultimately led to the same, like, sort of outcome, but the checklist kind of felt like it had a lot of steps. Whereas something like Coimbra, dice rolls work differently depending on what you're trying to do, but that's also because they're interacting with different mechanics or other systems. In this, it felt like one system that kind of flipped how you view dice rolls. I did want to say one more good thing, though. So,
okay.
Well, actually, it's kind of mixed. So this game has some kind of superfluous components, like the tombstones and the board. I don't really know why there's a board still. I guess it's a nice centerpiece. Tells you where everybody has to sit, which is kind of a mixed bag sometimes. The tombstones are like plastic cut, like, I don't know if they're 3D printed. Yeah, they're plastic molded pieces. The, like, they have some nice heft, some nice weight. One thing I do like is that the like, rings that you put around the tombstone are meant to be an unchiseled rock. And as you die, it chisels your tombstone more and more until when you're dead, it's a complete tombstone. That's like the flavor surrounding it, is it is a tombstone that is being carved as you play the game.
Got it. Okay. I can appreciate that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I do think it would have been nice to have like an option for a smaller box version.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So this is, I think this is where we're going to start to get more into some criticisms to this game.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so to your point, do you think it's right to say how much this game costs to buy on, Solid Roots' website?
I mean, it's open information.
Yeah.
You can just Google it. Okay,
so this game is,
yeah,
this game is a $40 game, which on one hand, for the quality of the plastic molded pieces and the custom dice,
the box insert,
you know, the artwork, the illustrations on the game, $40 for a game that has components like these isn't that bad of a deal. However, this game does not need these components, in my opinion.
Right.
Like, they are superfluous to the game. In some cases, they're sort of counterintuitive. Like, this is a party game, but there's a very hard limit on how many players can play because of these components. Like, because they have these fancy tombstones and a board that only has five slots, you can only play with up to five players. Although, even though, like, when I play party games, oftentimes there's more than five people playing.
Right.
So this wouldn't be an option if I was playing with my usual, like, party game group.
Right. I do have to wonder what it would be like if you substituted in dice and extra, like, health counters just to try out a larger scale game.
Yeah, I think so. If you were in a larger scale game, A, there would probably be more scares per round because you would get more like doubles and triples every round. So rather than just one person scaring in a round, three people would be scaring or two people would be scaring way more often.
Right. You could also have two trios or two quads instead of two pair being the only time you compare multiples.
Yes. There's probably also a limit to the cards. You'd probably need more cards so that everyone could have enough cards when they get eliminated. And so you would probably just have a couple extra copies of some of the basic cards, like changing the die faces. So there's a hard limit to this game, somewhat due to the mechanics. I think if you were to add more players, since there would be more scaring, you would probably just give everyone more health. Like, I could see that as being an easy way to offset that.
Right. But
Still play a functional game.
Right. But I think to kind of get back to our point about the game as it is, it feels like the components are nice, but they don't contribute much to the mechanics. I guess like the tombstones are a bit easier to judge when you can see the big sections of tombstone. I don't know how different it would be with, like, you know, small punch out health counters.
Or sure, like, it also doesn't leave it up to, like, interpretation or leave you guessing how many health somebody has.
Yeah.
Like, if it did use these punch-out counters, you know, how do you actually determine which pile is someone's health and which pile is the discard pile or what have you? With the tombstones case, at least they're on the tombstone when you have the health and you take them off the tombstone. So there's a very clear distinction between the pool of health that is active and the pool of health that has been discarded. And if you used a die, there's always chances that the die gets bumped. I think my fiance suggested maybe you could use a cardboard wheel, sort of like King of Tokyo, to track health. And, you know, if that was done well enough, it probably wouldn't slip too much.
Yeah, but I think, like, the board especially feels kind of pointless.
Yeah.
There's no real, it tells you where to put the discard pile, which is probably where you'd put it anyways, because most games have a centralized discard and draw pile.
Mm-hmm.
And then it tells you where to put your tombstones, but that doesn't really matter because there's no hidden information or no positioning focused abilities that would require strict positioning.
Plus, if you can't reach that because you're playing on a larger table, then you'd rather just have the tombstone sitting in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Just wherever you're sitting on the table.
Yeah. So I think superfluous components and cost, like, I think genre-wise, it would make sense for it to be sort of a smaller box game. You know, we just covered Flux and Chrononauts. Those are very small box games with a similar sort of take that style. And I don't know. I don't want to get too much into, like, designing the game for them, you know? I don't want to say what they should have done design-wise, because clearly they were confident enough in their design to publish it. But
yeah,
it does feel kind of awkward having a $40 game like this that's mainly the deck of cards.
Mm-hmm. That said, like, $40 for this quality of plastic molded pieces is, you know, a decent price. I think, you know, if I paid any more than $40 for this kind of game, I'd be like, what? I paid $40 for this, but at least, you know, the components are... I can understand why the cost is there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it makes sense to me why it would cost as much as it does.
Yeah. It's not like it's overpriced for the components. Mm-hmm. The components definitely set the price.
Also, to be fair, fancy components sell games.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sure if this game didn't have these big tombstones and the custom dice and the board with the big illustration on it, it might not have sold as many copies. It would have been cheaper, but if you're selling fewer copies, then, I mean, you're making less money overall.
Yeah. Who knows? It's kind of like how a lot of Kickstarted games have, like, minis that don't really need minis. It's because people like them.
Right. And those games go for over $100. And this is only $40, so.
I do like the table presence of this game, though. It does kind of come to that. Good tables. Yeah.
Yeah, this is probably a really good convention game because of that. You know, somebody walks past, they see these five big tombstones with big chunky health indicators.
They see
some of them are discarded.
Yeah,
they see the custom dice.
Yeah.
So it does present well and look pretty nice on the table.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is it doesn't really feel like it needs it. I want to say, I want to add to that too, though, that, like, once you sit down and play the game, I think a lot of people might come to the conclusion that the components are a little extra.
Mm-hmm.
Once the game is bought, it might lead to a little dissatisfaction.
Right. Yeah. So I love rules or not. I like rule books that encourage role playing. I think at least in a lot of the groups I've been in and have seen, people don't often role play for, like, normal board games unless they're prompted to. You know, like, they'll role play for a tabletop role playing game, but for your average, you know, take that game or your average Euro game, there's not really any role playing.
Yeah, playing Settlers of Catan, we don't ever pretend to be a settler.
Yeah, you don't act out your moves.
Right.
You know, if you're, even something like Betrayal is the closest comparison. I don't often get into the role-playing spirit until until I'm, like, the traitor, and the traitor's tome has this, like, elaborate personality or, like, you know, character that I'm playing now. Mm-hmm. You know, like if I'm a body snatcher in Betrayal, maybe I'll act more like a body snatcher or something, whatever that means. But
wait, how does a body snatcher act? Don't they just act like the person whose body they've snatched?
They always act a little too off from the person they've snatched. It's got to be uncanny.
Okay.
So for this game, it does have that aspect of like, you know, suggesting that you roleplay. But one problem I have with this is that the rulebook is almost too flavorful. This is probably a personal thing, but when I was reading through the rulebook, it was kind of hard to tell what text was important and what wasn't. Because, like, you know, there'll be paragraphs on the front that has just only flavor, and that's fine, you know, that's normal. But then, like, in each gameplay paragraph, it will, like, say something about the rules, then interject, like, a little joke, and then say another rule, and then interject another joke. And it does add some, like, it makes it not super dry, but it makes it a little harder as a reference document to function.
Mm-hmm. Could you give an example of this? Because you are the only one in the playgroup to read the rule book, and you just relayed the important rule information to us. Okay, I just wanted to say that I have a point to make about, like, the flavor of this game in a minute, and I think maybe part of that, like, you could maybe have a response to the point I might make about the flavor by saying, like, the rule book is, like, dripping with flavor. But the problem with that is that in a lot of playgroups, only one person reads the rule book, and it can be pretty tedious to read it out loud. So somebody might just read the rule book quietly to themselves and then relay how to play the game to the other players.
Yeah.
Or somebody might already know how to play the game, bring the game to a new playgroup, and just explain how to play it themselves without reading the rule book out loud from start to finish for the second time or whatever. Leaving a lot of that flavor to the rule book is not a good practice. Like, you probably want that flavor in multiple touch points than just the rule book.
Yeah, there's also a non-zero amount of people who have a hard time following somebody who's just directly reading from the rule book. Maybe the addition of, like, flavor and humor is to help them, but I think those people would still work better with, like, being shown examples in sort of the way I normally do it anyways. So here's the section about rolling from the rulebook for Fright, properly citing it. Be polite to start, because that will very quickly change. Turn the phase coin dice side up. Everyone rolls their single dice at the same time. Got it? Good. And then the rest of it is about... the rest of that paragraph is flavor. Goes on for about 5 lines.
Okay, so they're just having some fun with it.
Yeah.
All right, so...
I mean, and the flavor is about, like... A lot of the flavor stuff is about, like, you know, oh, everybody's going into the graveyard, and some of them might end up ghosts, but you better be prepared for that. But a lot of it is, like, kind of sassy in, like... I don't know, kind of making assumptions about the playgroup. Like, in the phase description, it's like, in a typical round, kinda, actually goes like this. Roll. Argue and or play cards. Argue some more. And then so on.
Okay.
It reminds me of Munchkin. That's it.
Well, I think that being said, Munchkin, like, the take that mechanics. First of all, I realize something now that, like, every time I was chosen to be scared and remove a health token, when we played, it just felt like, well, you had to choose somebody. I guess it was supposed to be me, and there's nothing I could have done to stop it. You know, unless I had that one specific card, which there's very few copies of in the deck. There's nothing I could do to stop it. You had to choose someone. I guess it's me. In Munchkin, at least, you know, like, there's cards that you could have in your hand to interact with that crucial moment where it's do or die, you know? You still have some ways to fight back. In this game, I guess you're meant to do all that fighting when you roll the dice and not when you're about to be scared. Maybe that's just a weird feeling, like I feel like that moment or that argument should be happening closer to the scare opportunity. But the scare opportunity, the scare phase of the game probably just comes and goes way too quickly. But then that goes to my next point, which is, like, there's nothing really scary about this game.
Yeah.
About scaring people. The mechanics are pretty dry. Like, it's just about rolling dice and winning the die roll. And all of the cards are just about manipulating the dice, really. There's a couple... There's maybe one card that I will give the game that has flavor mixed with mechanic, and that's the Resurrect card, which resurrects a ghost. You know, that one feels a little bit like, okay, there's so sort of a spooky name to the card, and it does something mechanically that can be construed as sort of spooky. Okay, plus for that. But then there's another card that's just like instant number 3, and that's the name of the card, and all it does is change a die to 3. Like, that's not scary.
Mm-hmm.
Very at all. Like, the flavor on the cards pretty much only comes from a little quote from like a spooky writer at the bottom of the card, like barely on the edge of the frame.
Yeah.
It
has the like zombie font.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
The design and the illustrations are spooky. I guess I'll also give them that. But like, when you get down to like what a card actually does and what you're actually doing in this game, you're not trying to scare each other. You're trying to roll dice in either low pairs or high singles, and all of the cards pretty much interact with the dice just to change them to either low pairs or high singles. And then once you've won the dice roll, then you technically do the thing that the game claims to be all about.
Yeah.
But on top of that, like, or not on top of that, but what that leads to is like the game heavily relies on you to make it fun and scary. Like, you have to construct the theme, not the game, not the game's designers. Like, you, the player playing the game, now has to figure out how to actually make it scary. Or, you know, which makes me think, like, does this game even have to be spooky themed? Like,
yeah,
it could have been themed anything. And I think if it was themed something else, I might like it a little bit more, because I guess for me personally, I'm not really in tune with scaring people and what it takes to scare somebody. So when the mechanics end and it comes down to the part where you get to inject a little personality and flavor into the game, I'm not that good at it. And when the game is so dry, even when you do put a concerted effort to actually scare somebody, it's not really the right, you know, tone or environment. Like, the tone is really mismatched to what you were just doing, in my opinion.
You know, this would work really well as like a Bang type, like, Western game, Western sure. theme. Then you could point at people and yell Bang, and then they would lose a health or something.
Sure. Maybe it would even, because I think we were also... Maybe that's something we could implement. So I'm sort of like talking ahead of myself.
Yeah.
You know, when we were playing, we didn't really have any sort of like moment where everyone chose who were they going to scare like at the same time. It's just like somebody would just decide to go first. Okay, I'll scare you. Boo.
Oh,
and then the next. Oh, there's rules on
this? Yeah, there's actually optional rules on the back that do say if you want, you can have everybody scare at the same time.
Okay, I believe this would be a slightly more interesting game if that was just the rule in general.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to know that the game suggests it. I'll give them points for that. But, you know, yeah, if it were like a different theme, like a quick draw shootout, then that would maybe even just lead the players to assume that's how you're supposed to do it, is you're supposed to do it at the same time, like 1, 2, 3, bang. The fright thing doesn't necessarily encourage you to use that rule, but at least they have that written in the game. I did it written in the game.
Yeah. So I want to bring up that their website, the Solid Roots website, say that this is a wholesome, scary game. And I think that really puts it into perspective for me, is that it kind of feels more like people telling ghost stories around a campfire in like going for cheap scares than it does a like horror movie where you are, you know, being chased or hunted or something or haunted. And so with that, the sort of lack or the like sort of like laissez-faire attitude towards it makes a bit more sense. The way like you're not really getting into these confrontations when people scare each other. It's more of just like, you know, you shrug it off a bit until the very last one.
Mm-hmm.
obviously in the game's lore, in the flavor of the game, you die. But I think the tone is supposed to be a bit more, are you afraid of the dark, than Scream.
Sure.
I do think it is okay for games to require players to roleplay to get the theme. I mean this in the sense that you could abstract some... there are a lot of tabletop role-playing games that you could abstract its mechanics and not make it about whatever the theme is. A lot of them kind of work on the assumption that the players are getting invested in the world.
Sure. Like, for example, Dungeons and Dragons is just about rolling a die, adding a number, and checking to see if that number is bigger than a number that's already been written down.
Right. I think if you treat this as a game where you are to, you know, pretend that you are actually scaring people and you kind of act along with it, I think that gives it more value. But I also don't think that it needs the, I don't know. I think it's okay as far as the amount of, reminding or the amount of theming it has. Like, maybe the board helps set the atmosphere by having a spooky tabletop. And, you know, maybe the tombstones really make it feel more like a cemetery. I don't know. I didn't have quite the same disconnect when I played it.
Mm-hmm.
I had felt like I was approaching it with the tone that it was wanting. I think there are definitely, like, games that are more immersive as a horror experience. But this doesn't feel like it's trying to be that.
Yeah, I can understand where you're coming from there, that, like, since this is meant to be a very gentle, scaring game, then it doesn't really need to set the atmosphere and, you know, at every twist and turn hit you with a bone-chilling idea. I guess, even with that being said, at least for me, the game, when I play the game, I'm focused way too much just on what numbers people rolled and what numbers I would like them to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't find that anywhere near the theme of even, like, gently spooky.
Yeah.
Like, oh, a two.
Something you did say, though, it does make me feel like I like the idea of, like, player interaction sandboxes where, like, the rules are light enough that you are allowed to make deals and scheme and backstab and whatnot. And maybe this would work better for a playgroup that is more used to that style of play, that is more willing to make deals at every opportunity and make, like, you know, I don't know, team-ups and stuff like that, make alliances. I don't know if this would necessarily be better, but it might be better. That's just something our playgroup isn't really prone to doing.
Maybe. I will say that the game doesn't really give you much to work with when it comes to, like, making deals, other than by just saying, like, oh, if I do get to scare, I won't scare you. Which, I guess, isn't nothing. That's not nothing. That's something in this game. I, like, if I could compare it to a game, there is a game called Dead Last that has similarly just says, like, do whatever you want. And then when everybody's good and done doing whatever they want, like, maybe you said, I think the game has a timer, like, do whatever you want in this time period, and then when the time's up, everybody makes a vote, like, 3-2-1 vote, and whoever gets the most votes is eliminated from the game, unless they played, like, a counter card rather than a vote card. But that game, like, I played that with a group of people that, you know, some of them I was friends with, some of them I hadn't really known all that well, but, like, we really got into, like, all the, like, the scheming and, like, you know, flashing signals at people and whispering and passing notes and stuff. Like, we got really into that game. But, like, this game, it doesn't, I don't know exactly when I would try to make my deal in this game. I guess I would make it, like, at the end of the dice phase before the scare phase, or, like, before I play a card in the dice phase. Maybe I could throw some deals out. I don't know. Maybe if I'd read the rule book, I would have understood, like, that was my opportunity to start talking to the players.
Yeah.
You know, I give that as a suggestion, but personally, I don't really know exactly what I'd say and when I'd say it in order to win this game.
Sure.
And especially because, like all the scheming, it's harder to scheme in such a small group. And again, in this game, when it comes down to it, like,
you can't stop a person from scaring you. In Dead Last, you can play the counter card. So even if you did all that scheming and you thought like, oh, I'm probably going to get targeted anyways, I'll just play the counter card. In this game, you could do all that scheming, but if someone goes back on your deal, whatever. Also, it's a lot up to luck. So,
yeah,
you know, no matter how much scheming you do, it could just be a game where somebody else ends up getting all the good rolls anyways.
Yeah.
Okay, do you have any more to say about Fright?
Nope. I think my like closing statement would be that it's pretty good for what it is. I hope that we've been able to give like a solid picture of what it is and what it isn't.
Yeah.
It's definitely like, you know, it's definitely a take that game with some luck that determines who gets to take what from whom.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I would place it.
Yeah,
we don't really do like ratings or review scores or anything. Sure. So that's my closing point.
Yeah. And again, there's things that I like about the game and there's things that I can appreciate about the game.
I think for all that I said about the rule book, it is interesting that like, or it is worth like reconsidering how much flavor is in a normal rule book, because some people have a hard time going through rule books.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability to make a game like able to be comprehended by somebody is really important. And if like adding more humor and more character to the rulebook narrator is what it takes, then this would be an interesting case study.
Mm-hmm. All right. That is our episode on Fright. Thank you again to Solid Roots for sending us the review copy. And thank you for listening. We will see you next time.
See ya.